You know, last time we were speaking of Arjuna's psychology, and we had made distinctions between different kinds of personalities, aesthetic and ethical and rational, and various combinations. And we are trying to see more and more clearly the combination that we obtain in the psychology of Arjuna. And the most important element that we had seen was that he is basically ethical. Now, what is ethical is to be understood much more deeply than we have done so far. We may say that ethical sense begins in a human being when he or she begins to feel that he should not do unto others what he or she does not expect others to do unto oneself. When this sense begins to preponderate, you can say you have now begun to have a true ethical sense. Now, in this sentence which I spoke just now, there are three elements. One is the concept of should. One should not do. So should is a very important word. The second word which is very important is others. And by others is not meant some others, but all the others. One should not do unto others or unto anybody. So there is a sense of all. And third is relationship of all with oneself. So all, oneself, and should. These three words are very important in the ethical sense. Now, there is a lower state of consciousness where there is sense of should, but with regard to others, you don't have the same connotation as all. For example, when one wants from all others everything, but one does not want to do the same to the others, one feels that one is so important that everybody should serve him or her. But as far as he or she is concerned, it is up to him or her pleasure. Now, when this consciousness is present, it means that you are not yet ethical. For example, when one seeks one's own pleasure, now there is a concept of ought or should. One should seek one's own pleasure. And one argues, why not? But very often, he does not apply the same sentence with regard to others. Suppose, for example, he said, I should seek my own pleasure. Then I go forward and say, let all seek their own pleasures. In an argument, the other party will say, yes, why not? All should seek their own pleasures. But then if you say, look, my highest pleasure consists in your sacrificing this pleasure, then what happens? All should seek their own pleasures. Fine. I should seek my own highest pleasure. But if somebody else's pleasure lies in your sacrificing some pleasure that you are seeking, then what happens? It is at that point that one feels that my own seeking of pleasure is more important than your seeking your own pleasure. Or you'll say, well, you find out your own way of pleasing yourself. Why should you put yourself on me? Why should your pleasure depend upon my sacrificing anything? So, in that condition, one feels to make oneself an exception to the rule and says, as far as I am concerned, I should seek my pleasure. If you want me to sacrifice, well, that you must make cancel out that aspect. I allow you to seek your own pleasure and seek your own highest pleasure, but don't impinge your pleasure on me, in which I am obliged to sacrifice something from my seeking of pleasure. Very often human beings, whenever they make some general rules, which applies to all, they want to make their own case an exception. Everybody else, all people should be like this, excepting that in my case there should be something which is extra, which is not demanded from others or which I do not want to part with. So here also there is a sense of should. But with regard to all, there is a kind of a limitation, a hesitation, and some kind of a compromise. This is not strictly an ethical sense. He said, one uses the language of ethics, but it's not strictly ethical. Now, Arjuna was an ethical being, and he knew very well that rules are to be applied to all, including himself. And he was living a life in which he was very considerate and very, very perseverant to follow the laws of ethics. That was his constant effort. In order to be sure, he was in the habit of consulting people, kindly come and sit here. Huh? He was constantly consulting people, consulting Dharma Shastras, consulting elders, so that his action is really ethical, really right, really good. Now this aspect has to be realized very well before we understand the crisis of Arjuna. This was very fundamental to him, that there is a law of conduct, law of action, dharma, and that dharma should be all the time observed under all circumstances. And whenever there is a conflict of what one should do, what one should not do, one should refer to dharma and take a decision according to dharma. Now this seeking of dharma, seeking of the law of action, was fundamental in the character of Arjuna. Now usually those who are highly moralistic are also in their psychology practical. Now let us understand this word practical, because there are many meanings of the word practical. Practical is certainly connected to the word practice. So, those who are inclined to practice may be regarded as practical. This is not the usual sense in which people use the word practical normally. Usual meaning of practical is one who succeeds, one who is able to compete very well, one who is able to see one's own interest in things and adjust his means and ends according to the benefit that one is going to derive. This is the normal sense in which the word practical is used. But the original sense in which practical is used or should be used is one who has tendency, inclination to practice, as opposed to theoretical. A theoretical consciousness is apt to reflect, to arrive at general ideas, general conclusions. And those who dwell all the time in the realm of ideas, generalities, theories, principles, very often there is a kind of a conflict between the theoretical and the practical. those who are turned to be practical in the real sense of the term, they do not very well fit in an atmosphere where people go on discussing theoretical ideas. What is the general principle, universal ideas, reflections, purely for the sake of search for the truth, for the sake of truth. And those who are theoretical, they begin to dwell in the plane of thought so much that for them to come down to the plane of action to put into practice, one has to make a very special effort. It is like if the thinker usually finds it climbing down to action. When he is in the field of thought, he feels he is very high and elevated. And when he comes to practicing something, he feels that he is climbing down. So usually there is a conflict between the theoretical and the practical. And many conflicts in the world arise because of the presence of these two elements in any given situation. There are some people who are theoretical, some who are practical. The highest combination is one where both theoretical and practical are so harmonized that one enters into theory and practice at ease. Now, in the case of Arjuna, he was prone towards practicing. Whatever he knew to be the right, he wanted to practice. He wanted to put into practice. But he had this deficiency, you might say, of entering into theoretical consciousness, a consciousness in which one discusses by reflection, by pros and cons. Now, when I say these words, it might seem rather strange because Arjuna was one of the best human beings of his time. And therefore, to speak of the deficiency of any such character might be misunderstood. So let us say that he was capable of thinking a lot. Not that thinking was alien to him. He was even sattvic in his personality. A sattvic human being is one who is constantly turned to light and harmony. This is the very definition of sattva. Tamas is inclination towards inertia, dullness, mechanical repetition. Rajas is a tendency or inclination to activity, feverish activity, intense activity, even rash activity, or impulsive activity. But sattva always gives you a poise of withdrawal from action. You cannot be very sattvic if you are not able to withdraw from action and stand out of action, stand above action to some degree. Now, to the extent to which Arjuna was sattvic in his temperament, he was already elevated. And every true ethical being is capable of thinking a lot before deciding whether he should do this or that or that or that. Take for example, to be ethical is to be self-controlled. This is the most elementary thing in any ethical personality. An ethical personality is self-controlled. Now, you cannot attain to self-control unless you are able to distinguish between your impulses and yourself, your desires and yourself, various alternatives before you. One, an alternative of self-indulgence, another the alternative of not indulgence, not indulging in something. Now, all these elements are present in Arjuna. But these are all parts of ethical personality of practical personality. When you speak of theoretical, and when I say there was a deficiency in Arjuna, in this regard, it is only when you consider a tendency in a to fly into the realm of ideas, where one can dwell in the realm of ideas for long periods of reflection. You might say purely philosophical temperament. Let us repeat. As soon as a human being attains to some kind of a rational element, a mental level, some kind of rationality, ethicality, and aesthetic elements begin to manifest. So every aesthetic being, every ethical being, every rational being is to some extent rational. And therefore is to that extent a thinker. Every thinker is to some extent a person who really can act and who can also do ethical activities. Every rational being has some kind of an opening to aesthetic sense and pursuit of joy and beauty at a higher level. Every one of them. And vice versa. So when I say that Arjuna was an ethical being, it does not mean that he was not capable of thinking and thinking very widely and very intensely. But what I mean to say is that he was not an elevated thinker, a philosopher, a theorist. Now, this can be understood best by those people who have been philosophers. If you have lived a life of a philosopher, you can understand how much you need to think and reflect. You need years and years to be reflective. And during that period, if anybody tries to take you away from thinking to action, you feel a tremendous disturbance. When Buddha, for example, left his home, he was in need of deep reflection. The questions that arose in his mind arose in the context of his personality, which was extremely wide, highly ethical and highly philosophic. In fact, Buddha represents one of the greatest heights of intellectuality. His questions were very deep questions. What is all this pain and suffering? What is this impermanence? What is illness? What is death? These were the questions he wanted to decide upon. What he should be doing, that was a subordinate question in his mind. His question was, what is the meaning of all this? So when he left his home, what was predominant in his personality at that time was to discover the truth of life, the meaning of life, the real process by which the world is constituted, in search of something that is permanent. It is that mind which may be called theoretical, philosophical. But Buddha was not only theoretical or philosophical. That was also a part of his personality. In other words, in the case of the Buddha, his intellectuality, his ethicality, these two were very prominent. One cannot say this aesthetic element was very powerful. His main center of his being was philosophical and ethical. In the case of Arjuna, his ethical is more predominant. You might distinguish between the two personalities by asking the following question. What is true is the basic question of a philosopher. What is the law by which I can act is the fundamental question of the ethical. What is true is the basic question of a philosopher. If you are a philosopher, your basic question will be, what is the real truth? Truth of existence. What is the reality? But if you are ethical, you will say, what is the law by which I should act? He is in search of the law of action. And throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita, when you read Arjuna's questions, you will find this predominance in his questioning. Tell me decisively what I should do. Do not speak to me in a mingled language. That was his complaint. When Sri Krishna speaks to him of the high principles of the immortality of the soul and the arrival of a consciousness which is samadhistha, when he really becomes state of equilibrium, settled intelligence, he seems to be somewhat impatient. He says, please tell me decisively what I should do. And even after reaching the soul consciousness, tell me what is the effect of it in action. Even his question is, how does a samadhistha move? How does he walk? How does he talk? These are his questions. His question is related to what is to be done. He doesn't ask deeper philosophical questions which arise out of the whole enunciation of Sri Krishna's description of reality. He doesn't say, what is this soul? From where has it come? Is there a higher reality than this? Or what is the truth of the, as she was asking me the question of independence, what is the truth of independence of the soul? Is his soul independent? Now these are very deeper questions of philosophy. He doesn't ask these questions at all. He says, now tell me what is to be done. It is this which is very remarkable in Arjuna's personality. The capacity to dwell upon pure thought for a long time is a mark of a theoretical personality, reflective personality, philosophical personality, personality of a seer, personality of a sage. Buddha had this personality very prominently in him. Actually, if you examine the crisis through which Buddha passed and the crisis which Arjuna passed at this stage of battlefield, you will get a very clear idea as to how the two crises are different and at two different levels. Buddha is prepared to spend years and years and years in the search of what is true, before asking the question, what should I do? If he withdrew from his home, it was only to get time to find out what is, or to reflect on this. It was not that he decided this was the right thing for him to do, and therefore he left. It was to gain time to reflect, so that here I have to now reflect on this question. And this circumstance does not permit me to reflect. So unless I withdraw completely and go into a great seclusion and reflect and go from teacher to teacher and ask questions, unless I do it, I will not be able to come to the real conclusion. Of course, he was highly ethical, therefore, he really ultimately wanted to do what was right. But what he wanted to find out was the basis of doing the right thing. So he has a very powerful and very wide philosophic nature and the ethical nature, both together. In the case of Arjuna, the philosophic element was not so wide as in the case of the Buddha. Philosophic element was not absent, but that philosophical element was highly moralistic, highly inclined to do something and to follow some law of action so that he can apply and say that, well, I've done the right thing. That is his basic inclination. So you might say that Arjuna was ethical, Arjuna was practical. Third element in his personality was that Arjuna was emotional. Now here again, there is a conflict between intellectuality and emotionality. Again, we cannot say that he was not intellectual. But that intellectual element was subordinate to the emotional element. In an emotional personality, there is always a great consideration to enjoy with others. It's a sense of expansiveness in which you share your joy with a large number of people. You feel happy in the happiness of others. If somebody is unhappy or sick or troubled, you feel very much overpowered. It is said that Indians by nature are more emotional than many people of the West. A simple appeal of a poor person can melt most of the Indians more easily. An argument may not actually interest many people in India as much as a mere experience of emotional stir. Now, Arjuna was a personality that could be moved very powerfully through emotions. He is my uncle, he is my grandfather, oh, he is my companion, oh, he is my comrade. And to share with them whatever you enjoy, even your victory should be shared with these people who are your own people. Now the appeal of this, my own people, and sharing with the people is extremely important for an emotional personality. And that was a mark of Arjuna. Finally, he was a sensational man. Again, I use the word sensational not in the ordinary sense of the term. A sensational person is one who gets greatly affected by what one sees and what one hears. There are people who understand a thing when one hears. There are people who get much more convinced when one sees, not only hears, but one sees. There are people who are convinced when they read in printed word. Somebody saying or somebody seeing is not so important as when one reads in printed word somewhere. Some get convinced only when they read again and again, 3 times, 4 times, 5 times, to be absolutely sure. They require so much of evidence in writing, then only one gets absolutely certain. Now, this last category cannot be said sensational. They are really hard rationalists who want all the evidence on paper in writing, and they want to read again and again to be sure that what is said is true. And then only their action will follow out of what they read. They need a lot of time to reflect. They do not normally get affected immediately by what they hear and what they see. On the other hand, there are people who, even if they have read 10 times, and they have got all the evidence in writing, but they are not absolutely sure until they have seen or heard somebody saying something. This is a mark of sensationality, one who gets very much seized by sensations. Now, having analyzed this, let us start with the sensationality of Arjuna. I was so far building up the case for the sense of crisis which overcomes Arjuna rather suddenly. Arjuna is brought in the arena in the chariot by Shri Krishna. He knew that he was going to fight against the arrogance and violence which was symbolized and manifested in Duryodhana. He was sure that he was doing according to what a kshatriya ought to do. There was a law of a kshatriya, and the dharma of kshatriya is to fight for justice and to establish what is right. He knew this very well. He was moved by this law of action and he wanted to do it. He knew also that in this great conflict, people of different parts of the country or different countries were to participate. He knew also that among them, they were all people of his own clan. He knew that in the opposition, there were also people of his own family, not only of his clan, but of his own family. Among his opponents were his gurus, Dronacharya, Kripacharya, and so he knew all this. And now he is brought into the arena. And as soon as he watches all this, what happens to him? What he knew is now experienced sensationally by him. He sees with his own eyes Bhishma standing here, and Dronacharya there, and his brothers, his comrades, friends, peers, people who have been working with him and for whom he was working. All those people are arranged before him. It is this sensation which overpowers him. And all his thoughts are generated by this sensational experience. This is the true psychology of what happens to Arjuna. He knew already, otherwise he knew all this, that this was, these are the two parties and this is the battle. Then what is it that changes him suddenly? What is the new situation? What is that new in the situation? By which his whole mind is changed completely. He had come to fight, he wanted to see everybody like a majestic master of the whole situation. And suddenly he changes. What is it? The only explanation we can give is that he was a personality which can be affected by sensations. What you knew in theory, in thought, it was not so real to him. If he was a theoretical person, if he was a philosopher, then what one thinks becomes highly real. But because he's a pragmatic, practical, emotional, ethical, and sensational, therefore what comes through sensations seizes him very powerfully. And then not only it seizes, but immediately the currents of thought pass through him so powerfully, and he says, my limbs, his own organs, physical organs, sensational experience, they become numb. It's a sensational experience. Antime gatrani. My organs of the body, they simply become numb. Now, these experiences now lead him to a series of thoughts. Yes.
Another intellectual being, you said that the emotion wants to share. What did you have to say for the intellectual person in that respect?
He also wants to share, but rather sharing thoughts. Also, but it's a subordinate thing. Very often a thinker is very happy when you tell him, now you tell me your thoughts. He may not be able to give you a dinner party very easily. He may not even think of it, unless he has also a developed emotional personality. I am talking of those who are predominantly thinkers and those who are predominantly emotional. Those who are predominantly thinkers You ask a question, immediately starts a kind of a analytical assessment of a situation or analytical statement of the process of thought. It's very peculiar. When she asked me the question, I went immediately into analysis. That shows my personality. I am more inclined to a reflective process of explaining. If there was somebody else, he could have even given an experience to her of the answer to the question that she put to me. That could be a higher capacity than the capacity that I provide myself to myself. So I can share with others an analysis which is more easy for me. I can immediately enter into analysis. It's a mark of a thinker rather than a man of an emotion, although I am quite emotional also. But I am predominantly a thinker. So in my case, it's not easy for me to share emotion so easily. It's so easy for me to share the analysis of thought.
And does the emotional, intellectual, or ethical being have a evolutionary gradation, or they're just...
Oh, no, you're right. There are many gradations. That is why whenever you analyze, you find it very difficult because, as I was saying, that Arjuna was ethical, but not rational. Now, this will be a big injustice to Arjuna. Because it is not that he was not rational. On the contrary, therefore I have made a remark that actually every ethical, rational and aesthetic being has a sufficient modicum of rationality. But when I make a distinction, it is a question of the gradation. That when one moves more and more in the ethical level, then his dwelling upon the philosophical level becomes less and less pronounced. Ultimately, there should be harmony of all the three together. In fact, one of the greatest difficulties of any culture, not only of a human being, but even of a culture, is that cultures tend to become specialized in one or the other. Take, for example, the culture of Athens and culture of Sparta. This is one of the earliest examples of a conflict between two cultures. This is in Greek civilization. These two were very powerful cultures in ancient Greece. Athenian culture and Spartan culture. Now, what is the difference between the two? Both were rational. But philosophical thought and pursuit of beauty were prominent in Athens. But pursuit of the right, of the good, of the strong, of one who can endure, the pursuit of stoicism. You know, in Sparta, there was a rule that if a child, when he is born, and if he is a weakling, it was thrown off from a mountain. They did not want children who are weaklings. They wanted really children who are brave and powerful. Now today when we think of it, it may give us a terrible shake in our being. How cruel these people. But they were so powerful as far as the capacity of endurance is concerned. They wanted to create a race of people who can bear all kinds of sufferings and all kinds of privations. Now this was unthinkable in Athens, where the aesthetics and intellectuality were very much emphasized. So you can see here two cultures where one was very predominant, the other was less predominant. And the other way, in Athens, this pursuit of stoicism was less prominent. Not that it was absent, but less prominent. Again, when you see, for example, the distinction between the Greek culture and Roman culture. What was the difference between the two? Now you take Greek as a whole, not Athens and Sparta separately, but you can see Greek culture and Roman culture. What was the basic difference between the two? Romans were nearer to Sparta than to Athens. Roman culture was nearer to Spartan culture than to Athenian culture. In the sense that Romans were also great adherents of law. Law, order, organization. Heavy hand to see that things are done. Not a questioning mind as to what is right, what is wrong. It was assumed, you know what is right, what is wrong. And then the question is, what is to be done? This is the reason why they conquered Greece. Because Greeks were thinking. And they were pursuers of beauty. Sculpting art and making architectural designs which are so beautiful. And because they lacked this element, which Spartans had in a great measure, therefore Greeks were conquered and Greeks became even slaves. And this is the trouble which arises in culture. A good thinker can be very well made a slave of a practical man, which happens very often. Scientists are hired by rich people. And then rich people can command them, and the poor thinkers have to spin out so many ideas in service of the rich people and the powerful people. This happens all the time. So in cultures also it can happen. The Greeks, even great philosophers, had to work as slaves of the Roman masters. It is said actually, that Greeks were so clever because of the thinking power, they knew very well what will please their masters, and therefore they would spin out stories which would please them, and therefore gain favors from them. And ultimately, they were so clever that all their culture, they simply rolled upon Romans, so that ultimately Romans became Greeks. By their intellectual power, their power of persuasion, their power of maneuvering and intelligent understanding. So that is why once Romans had conquered the Greeks, there arose what is called Greco-Roman culture. So actually Roman culture did not remain Roman at all. It became highly influenced by Greek culture. So there arose a Greco-Roman culture in due course of time. And that was the great conquest of the Greeks. The Greeks conquered Romans not by warfare, but there it was a conquest of the mind.
So the perfection can be defined as
that. That's right, correct, absolutely. Perfection is integration of ethicality.
It was not easy to make this big transition. The answer of the ethical question which was raised by Arjuna did not rest in ethicality. It was on a higher plane, and Sri Krishna had to lead Arjuna to a higher plane of consciousness. Now how to lead him to a higher level of consciousness? The one element which was left by Arjuna as an opening, the higher level was Arjuna's argument that he should renounce. He must not fight, he must renounce, he must go away. Now this idea of renunciation is slightly higher than the ethicality. In ethics you have got to do. Whereas what he said, I will not fight, I will renounce. Now this was a small element left in his whole argument, and it was through this door that Sri Krishna ascends higher. That all right, you talk of renunciation, I'll tell you what is renunciation. And this whole argument starts with renunciation. You can see the first 3-4 chapters are only about what is actionable as renunciation. So it is through that door that Sri Krishna takes Arjuna upwards. And because Sri Krishna's answer is on a higher plane, and Arjuna is not able to reach that higher plane, he constantly says, all right, come now back to the brass tacks. And when you say that knowledge is superior to action, because that was one of the propositions that Sri Krishna made at certain stage. He said, if you think intelligence is much higher than action, then why do you throw me into action at all? And I'm already saying that I want to go from here. So Arjuna's crisis can be understood first when we understand his psychology. That was the reason why we are dwelling upon this so much. Otherwise, we won't understand why this whole debate is on. It was the psychology of Arjuna, which is peculiar psychology. He has come to his crisis first of all through sensation, because he was a person who can be affected through sensation. Sensationally, his crisis is a sense of horror. To imagine horror is one thing, but to see the horror before his eyes, which he now could see much more easily when he sees such a huge expanse of armies standing before him, than an imagination that these people will ultimately be slaughtered. Tremendous sense of horror seizes him. Not that he could not imagine earlier. He was capable. He had done it. He has fought so many wars. But to see this huge arena filled with people, and among them his grandfather and his brothers and his closest relatives and friends. So first of all, sensationally his crisis arises in the sense of horror. Then there's a sense of pity. He feels as if he has great pity for everybody, because so many are going to be killed. And then sensationally feels disgust. There are three words which are very important to understand the sensational crisis. Sense of horror, pity, and disgust. What is all this? What is the meaning of all this? Therefore, now comes the second level of his crisis, the vital crisis. What is the vital crisis? The loss of attraction. Usually the vital being is enjoined upon action by attraction. You like this, you don't like this. It is like, dislike, preference, and rejection on the basis of your preferences. Now, there is a loss of attraction. Loss of attraction of all the ordinary aims of life in which you were living up till then, which we will expound later on when we see his real argument, which he enunciates himself. His ordinary aim of life was what? First, normally we all live for joy, for happiness. And that is his first argument. Now come say, I don't desire now anymore, he says. The loss of the attraction to life and the aim of life. The normal aim of life is to have happiness and joy, which he says, I don't want it. Or, what do you want further in your life? You want to help others. You want to have victory. But for what? Victory to share with your own people. But these are the very people who are to be killed. So with whom will you share your happiness? So if these are the very people with whom you would like to share your victory, if they are the very people to be killed, then what's the point in doing it? This is his vital crisis. Then there is an emotional crisis. What is his emotional crisis? Here is my grandfather, my friend. All these have to go. I mean, the people with whom you are enjoying your whole life, all to be slaughtered. So this is the emotional crisis. And then there is the practical crisis. What is the practical crisis? The practical crisis is that all life is to put into practice the highest that you regard in the terms of morality, good, right, justice. This is practicality, to see that the right wins in the world, justice wins in the world. Now, following this path, we now see that following this very path, he has reached a point where all he thinks is right and just ultimately will be destroyed at the national level. And this is a very important perception. In order that there should be right and justice, there should at least be people. And people who are themselves devoted to right and justice, then only you can say that you have now worked for justice and right. But now, the action to which he has now come at present is arrived at by pursuing the path of the right. He now sees that by doing this very action, he will come to a situation or create a situation where human beings devoted to the right and justice will be destroyed on a large scale. And manhood in the country will be destroyed. The women will go astray. And there will arise a whole people, Varna Sankara, the people who have no idea of right and good. You see, this is the consequence which will arise out of this. So, doing the right and justice, pursuing that path, he is going to create a situation where for a long time or for many, many years, even centuries, there will be a complete disorder who will not even think of the right and justice. This was his great practical crisis.
But it was the destruction of evil which he set out for.
True, that's why he says, I want to destroy evil. Ultimately, I will arrive at what point? Where people themselves will become evil. You see the argument. I will slaughter thousands of young men. Therefore, lots of women will become widows, who will then go astray and will produce generations of people who will be born out of going astray from their life. Therefore, the generations will not obey the law of the right and justice. The path of evil will be more easily amenable to those people who are born out of such a crisis in their life. Now, this is not fully expounded in the Gita because it's not so easy to say. But he says that Kulastriya, the women, will go astray. When manhood on a large scale is destroyed, what will happen to women? They will go astray. And then children will be born on a large scale. In what condition? Therefore, he speaks of Varna Sankara. The people who are born will be born who are out of their varna, that is to say, out of the dharma. Therefore, you will not be able to preach them what is the dharma. This was the great challenge that comes before him now at this stage. In fact, this is the point which we shall expound further because it's a very important point. The crisis of Arjuna is not only sensational, not only emotional, not only practical. It is a deeper crisis. It's a crisis where the whole idea of morality itself becomes questionable. If by doing the right thing, you ultimately create a wrong thing, what happens to your right thing? This is the question. You do your right thing. You destroy the evil. By destroying the right, by destroying the evil, if you really create more evil, then what do? You want to destroy the evil, fine. But if by destroying the evil, ultimately you produce more evil, a greater evil, an irremediable evil, what will happen? This is the crisis. This is the question that they quote. Arjuna's questions are really difficult actually. Only Sri Krishna could have given this answer that he gave, because his questions are very, very formidable. So the process through which Arjuna passes is of a very tremendous type. As Sri Aurobindo says, you could not have the kind of great teaching of the Gita unless the crisis to which is an answer itself is a great crisis. More crisis could not have produced such a big teaching. It's a crisis in which some of the most fundamental questions of human life are to be answered. And the situation was such that the questions arise in the mind of Arjuna only at that moment. And that is why the crisis becomes so difficult. And in a sense even typical, because most of the human beings are of the type of Arjuna. Very few people are thinkers and philosophers and so on. But most of us are largely emotional, practical, ethical, and sensational. We are all basically of that type. And our crisis usually comes in this fashion. You may have decided 100 things, but when you see the situation, you are completely changed. When you sensationally see a situation, the whole heart melts. You may have thought that you want to vote for one, but when you really see something else, you vote for somebody else. At the last moment, some appeal comes from somewhere, and emotionally you are carried away.
Rational
development, as you said, it's a very typical thing. Yes.
So,
also,
personal.
Oh, yes. That is why it's such a great relevance to us. Why we read the Gita? Because we find our own life portrayed in the Gita. We find that Arjuna is ourselves. And that is why we turn to the Gita at every step, because the questions that Arjuna asks are so dear to us. These are the very questions that we would like to ask. I would now like to give you the text of Arjuna's argument, first in Sanskrit and then in English, so that we can study this more carefully. And it is translated by Sri Aurobindo. That's what everybody has got? Yes. Now, I don't know how many of you know Sanskrit, but doesn't matter. I should like to read out. In any case, it is good to read in Sanskrit itself, because it will give us a direct sensational experience of Arjuna's own argument. Sidanti mama gatran mukham cha parishasyati. Vepatuscha sarire me roma harshascha jayate. Gandivam santape hasta. Tvakcha eva paridahyate. Natashaknomi avasthatum brahmati ivachal me mana. Nimittani cha pasyami viparitani keshava. Natashreyaha anupasyami. Hatva svajanam ahave. Na kanshe vijayam Krishna, na cha rajyam sukhani cha. Kim no rajyena govinda, kim bhogaihi jivitena va. Yesham arthe kanshitam no rajyam bhoga sukhani cha. Te ime avasthita yudhe pranam chakva dhanani cha. Acharyaha, pitaraha, putraha, tathaiva cha pitamahaha, matulaha, shashuraha, pautraha, shyalaha, sabandhinastata. Etanda hantum ichhami, gnatopi madhusudana, apit vairokya rajyasya heto, kim namahi krute. Nihatya dhardrashtram nahakat pitihi sarjanardana. Pakum eva ashraye asman hatva etan akatayinaha. Asman na aha vayam antum dhardrashtram so bandhavan. So janam hi katham matva sukhina hatyama madhava. Yadi api ete na pashyanti lopa upahatat chetasaha kulakshayam kulakshayakritam dosham mitra grohe cha patakam katham na geyam asmabhihi papat asman tiva vartitum kulakshayakritam dosham prapashyat vihi janardana Kulakshaye pralashyanti kuladharmaha sanatanaha. Kulakshaye pralashyanti kuladharmaha sanatanaha. Dharme nashte kulam krishnam adharmaha abhivavati utara. Adharma abhivavat krishna pradushyanti kulastriya. Trishu dushtashu vashneya jayate varnasankara. Sankaraha kulagnanam kulaschaca patanti pitarohiyesham lukta pindo udakatriyaha. Doshaihi etaihi kulagnanam varna sankaraitaihi utsadyante jati dharmaha kuladharmascha shashvataha. Utsanna kuladharmanam manushyanam janardana Narake aniyatam vaso bhavati iti anushushruma. Aho bata mat papam kartum yavasitavayam. Yad rajasukha lobena hantum sojanam ujjataha. Yadi mam apratikaram ashastram shastra pranaya. Dhatrashtraha rane hanyuhu tat me kshematram bhave. Evam bhuktva arjunaha sankhe rathaupaste upavishat risujya tasharam chapam shoka sang vignam manata. These are the cries of all the crises of which I have spoken, all the crises. Sensational crises, vital crises, emotional crises, practical crises. Now let us read in English. On page number 78, you have got 78? I am reading something which was not read in Sanskrit, but it is important to understand the context. Right in the midst, between either horse, set thou my car, O unfallen. He speaks to Shri Krishna. Arjuna says to Shri Krishna, right in the midst between either horse, set thou my car. Let me scan thee who stand arrayed and greedy for battle. Let me know who must wage war with me in this great holiday of fights. Fain would I see who are these that are here for combat to do in battle the will of Dhritarashtra's witless son. This is the proud, great Arjuna, decided to win the battle of justice. This is the spirit in which he comes to the battlefield. Thus, O Bharata, to Rishikesha, Gudakesha said, who sat in the midst between the either army, the noble car, in front of Bhishma and Drona, and all those kings of earth. And he said, Shri Krishna said, Lo, O Partha, all these Kurus met in one field. Their Partha, so father and grandsire stand, this is a sensational experience, their Partha, so father and grandsire stand, and teachers and uncles and brothers and sons and grandsons and dear comrades and fathers, of wives and hearts, friends, all in either battle of oars. And when the son of Kunti beheld all these dear friends and kindred facing each other in war, his heart was touched with utter pity and failed him. And he said, "O Krishna, I behold these kinsmen and friends arrayed in hostile arms, and my limbs sink beneath me, and my face grows dry, and there are shudderings in my body, and my hair stands on end. Gandiva falls from my hands, and my very skin is on fire." This is the sensational experience. "Yeah, I cannot stand, and my brain whirls, and evil omens, O Keshava, meet my eyes. I can see no blessing for me, having slain my kin in fight." This is the emotional crisis, the vital crisis. "I desire not victory, O Krishna. No kingship, no delights." This is the vital reaction, the vital crisis. All the ordinary enjoyments of life, they mean nothing now to him. There is a vital disgust over there. "What shall we do with kingship, O Govinda? What with enjoyments? What with life? Therefore, whose sake we desire kingship and enjoyments and delights? Lo, they all stand in battle against us, casting behind them their riches and lives, our teachers and our fathers and our sons, our grandsires and uncles and the fathers of our wives, and our grandsons and our wives' brothers and the kin of our beloved. These, though they slay me, O Madhusudana, I would not slay. No, not for the empire of heaven and space and hell, much less for this poor earth of ours. Slaying the sons of Dhritarashtra, what joy would be left to us, O Janardana? Sin alone would find lodging in us if you slew these, though our adversaries and foes. Therefore, we do not write to slay the children of Dhritarashtra and their friends. For how can we be happy of Madhava if we slay our kin? Even though these see not, for their hearts are swept away by grief, error done in the ruin of our house, and grievous sin in treachery to natural friends. How shall we not understand and turn back from the sin? We who have eyes, O Janardana, for error done in the ruin of our house. When the family dwindles, the eternal ideals of the race are lost. And when ideals are lost, unrighteousness besets the whole race. In the prevalence of unrighteousness, O Krishna, the women of the race go astray. And when women grow corrupt, bastard confusion is born again. But confusion brings the slayers of the race and the race itself to very hell. For the long line of fathers perish, and the food ceases, and the water is given no more. By these sins, who bring their race to perdition? Fathers, they are bastard confusion. The eternal ideals of the nation and the hearth are overthrown. And for men who have lost the ancient righteousness,
Sri Krishna says that all actions, whereas they are all blinded, but he is very fully. For men who have lost the ancient righteousness of the race, in hell an eternal habitation is set apart, it is told. Alas, a dreadful sin have we set ourselves to do, that we are made ready from greed of lordship and pleasure to slay our own kin. Yeah, even if the sons of Dhritarashtra slay me with their armed hands, me unarmed and unresisting, it were better and more fortunate for me than this. Thus spake Arjuna, and in the very battle's heart, sat down upon his chariot seat and let fall his bow when the arrow was under strain, for his soul was perplexed with fear. Tushas Prabhupada today, huh?